The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We are live from New York City today. It is a bit chilly in New York. There's not much snow at the moment, but it's definitely cold, in the low 20s last night when I was walking home from the office in Midtown to the East Village Way, it's really unusual for a guy who was born in Australia and then lived in Hong Kong and then Dubai to be dealing with this cold weather. We have in the New York studio, we have Joe Pagano. Say hello, Joe.
Hey, Brett. Hello, everyone. Great to be here.
And we have on the line Alex Lightman. Alex. I couldn't hear Alex. Could you?
You heard him before.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Yep. You're there. Hey. So Alex Lightman, MIT graduate and author of many books. And also, Alex, I was really, really interested in your new venture that you've just started, which has to do with the solar trees. Is it called Eversun or Everbright? I'm going from
memory. Everblaze.
I knew it was ever something.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about that, because I was really interested in that. I saw that the other day and I thought, brilliant idea.
Sure. Everblaze is an attempt to bring the new advances in renewable energy together with my decade-long interest and work in telecommunications. We're building Evertrees, E-V-R-T-R-E-E, Evertrees that will be put in cities to provide bandwidth and electrical charging for mobile phones and for electric vehicles, electric scooters, electric bikes, so that people will be able to see themselves getting their power, getting their energy from the sun. Because right now, solar panels are roof-mounted. They're out of sight. They're out of mind. I mean, I would challenge you to be able to look at buildings in New York and look at them as closely as you want and tell whether they get any of their power from solar or not. Or they're ground-mounted, in which case they're like Ivanpah. They're very large if you're driving between California and Nevada near the state border. They're obvious, but you don't generally see it. And I want to bring it up so that people can say, oh, wow, I got my power from the sun today. Maybe I can do that at home. Maybe I can do that at work. Maybe my kids can do that at school. And because the trunk of the tree gives us space, we can put in batteries, charge them for 36 hours, and we can provide Wi-Fi without any cables, without any wiring. So imagine you're at a college campus, and you have Wi-Fi in your buildings, but then you have these big open spaces. Like, think of Stanford's campus or any big spread-out university. Why not put these trees up, and people can charge, and they can get their Wi-Fi while they're outside, perhaps having lunch. So that's one of the six products that we have. Another big one is an ever pivot, which allows farmers to free themselves from paying for electricity to irrigate their crops.
Fantastic. So if you guys want to check out, you can check out actually Alex's Facebook page. A. Lightman is his Facebook name. And he's got a picture of him standing under one of these metal trees. And that's the best way to describe it, with this this space for the solar panels that are going in. And this will be you'd be able to put these in car parks and have free Wi-Fi or have Wi-Fi hotspots and also charge your Tesla if you're in California, right?
Yes, there's a garage that Santa Monica built that's sort of like a poor man's Pompidou Center. There are stairs on the outside, and it's got 32 spaces for charging. And A friend of mine got a Fiat E500 after my relentlessly asking to get an electric car. And in the beginning, there were plenty of empty spaces. It's now very challenging to get a space because they're all filled with cars. So I've gone through and with a videotape, and I'm just shocked at how much electric vehicles have flooded Santa Monica. So here's what I would say. It's a new field of dreams. If you build electric charging space, whether from Evertrees or from normal charging in parking lots, people will fill them with electric vehicles.
Build it and the Teslas will come.
Yes.
Great. So I think you guys should be exporting this to Finland and Norway, where Teslas are like the number one selling car there. But very, very interesting. So, Alex, the reason we wanted to kick you off on the show this week is you're our on-the-ground reporter at CES, and we didn't do a CES show during CES, but I thought we would follow up with some of the more interesting gadgets. You're particularly big on the quantified self and the wearable space. So, and first of all, before we get into banking, just tell us what CES was like, and you know, there was tons of stuff happening there. What caught your eye as a futurist and, you know, technology commentator in respect to what was happening in CES? Any trends that we should be looking at?
Sure. Well, I think you're performing a vital public service because only 0.00002% of the world's population, or one out of every 44,000 people, was able to see the future at CES. And I've been going on and off for 20 years, and this was my favorite show. Finally, the magic is back. Finally, there are things that I saw that surprised me that were new and novel and could make the world a better place. So I love the Lucy light. It's a light that's kind of like a small inflatable plastic case that you put out in the sun and will give you several hours of light. So there's something like 3 billion people in the world who the world shuts down for them when the sun goes down. They can't do their homework. They can't do any work at home. And this gives it back to them. So I love that. On the other side, just so it doesn't seem too goody-two-shoes, there are now internet-connected guns so that you can take them out, and as you're hunting, people can go and see through your scope, your video, live streaming your hunt. The quantified self devices were shocking in their profusion. I just can't imagine that this can continue. I took one picture that had over 100 form factors from one company for things that would go around your wrist. And by the way, I have a Vivo Fit around my wrist. I love it so much. But it recording almost everything. I was a little bit surprised by how the Chinese are marketing it. I never saw so many nude people at a consumer electronics show, all of them from Chinese companies. And, I mean, I can send you some pictures where there's this nude woman with just minnows over where her nipples would be, just barely concealing them, and it's, you know, selling you quantified self stuff from this company. But there, one of the things that I found really exciting was the smart yoga mat. It's $297, and even though I have the world's greatest concentration of yoga studios within one block of me, I thought of getting it because everybody is so good at yoga around me. They're, you know, imagine if you were going to be an E10 in Kenya where the average person can run, you know, a 4.5 minute mile and you just want to go out and jog. Well, it's like that doing yoga in Santa Monica, but here's a mat that will tell you exactly where to put your foot and whether your butt is high enough in downward dog, etc., in a really pleasing voice. So it uses a camera and uses sensors on the mat. And what we see is that the quantified self is just spilling out of the watch and just going crazy. Right. And there drones were everywhere. I love the drone that you can wear on your wrist that then flies off and does something for you and then flies back and attaches you. That sort of like reminds me of a pirate with a parrot, or a witch with a crow as a familiar that will go off and do your bidding and tasks and then come back and be your private creature. And there were cages for the drones all over. I wonder when they'll let the drones run free.
Did you see that piece on an MIT professor has developed now a 3D printer that can print drones?
I
should send you that. I should send you that. We did have we got someone from Bali just sent in a note, Alex, to you saying that $297 for a yoga mat. Seriously, we get them free in Bali. Thanks, Andy. So, but it is a smart, it's a smart yoga mat, right? That's the point.
But try and buy a free coconut in LA. I mean, some things are free. But what I like is the idea is to have the privacy and not be embarrassed at how bad I do something.
Sure.
Neurogenesis requires us to be in this place of conscious incompetence for quite a while. And the more things that we can do that allow us to be consciously incompetent without also being embarrassed, the better for our brains.
So
you mentioned 3D printing.
Sorry.
Do you want to talk about that?
Go ahead.
A second?
Yeah, sure, please.
So I spent a lot of time looking at 3D food printers because I've been fascinated with the worldwide publicity and success of Natural Machines, which makes a food printer called the Foodini. And so I was looking at their competitors, and I was shocked at the idea of these 3D food printing companies wanting to flood the world with obesogens, things that make us fatter and sicker. So at 100% of what was being 3D printed and advertised, and even in the videos, it wasn't just the materials, were cookies and cakes and candies and chocolates.
And, yeah.
And I believe that the chocolate, the Choco Jet, I'm pretty sure that there was plastic mixed with the chocolate because of the consistency of the chocolate that they had. And they were, I ate so much bad candy, it was kind of crazy. In the Chef Jet booth, they were printing out candy skulls, and they had a giant white 1 foot long 3D printed cockroach. And I thought, wow, this is absolutely perfect for the way that they're displaying 3D printing things.
Unbelievable. So Internet of Things connected device. We saw Mercedes launch their self-driving car with a concept that it basically becomes this third place or entertainment space.
Yes.
You know, what do you get? What do you get?
Wrong way.
Sorry?
From the road.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, you know, one of the reasons we got you on the show is, of course, you were deeply involved in the IPv6 movement in terms of getting that in place for the explosion of the Internet Things. You worked with the White House and on policy regarding that. So
yes. Well,
do you see that we're starting to really build that platform now of Internet of Things?
Well, what's interesting to me is that the demand for bandwidth is going to go through the roof, and policy is lagging way behind.
Right.
Alvin Toffler, in his book, his most recent book, was talking about how technology is sprinting ahead at 60 miles an hour and laws and policies are toddling around it behind at 2 miles an hour. He has a whole very funny kind of cartoonish view of this. And every one of these devices, as I was looking at it in my mind, I automatically do this kind of augmented reality overlay of, oh my God, how much bandwidth will this take and how much bandwidth will that take? And of course, if you have something like the VivoFit, you can have your Bluetooth connected device you come to at home. But these cars are meant to be in continuous contact. And I don't know where they think the network that's going to do this affordably and reliably is going to come from, given the policy machinery in the United States. And one kind of sad fact about that and how much people ignore policy is, here's a conference with 170,000 people, and the first chief technology officer of the United States government from the White House, who I'd met before, was there signing his books, and I had no problem being, you know, one of two people who were there talking with him for quite a while, because people just don't think policy matters. But we need a 21st century policy to enable the bandwidth for all of these devices, or we're just going to be set up with private enclaves that people are not going to be able to access. And most people will be on the slow lane and donkey speed.
Well, you know, we're going to do something between 9 to 10 zettabytes of content this year, which, if you extrapolate that or you want a comparison, we're talking about 130 million books that have been published throughout all history, 130 million different titles. And today we produce the equivalent of that same amount of content 80 million times a day. And, of course, it's growing very, very rapidly. So this is an infrastructure issue.
There's a fakeness of that statistic. I would call that a Potemkin broadband. Remember the whole story of the Potemkin village, where the Tsar was going to go see ordinary people, and they built this happy village with actors for the Tsar to look at for a day? So the reality is that the U.S. government is moving all these files around between its foreign bases and the United States. Guess how they do it? They do it with a C-130. They do it by putting all these printed manuals and all these tapes and things in a plane and flying it back and forth at the cost of tens of thousands of dollars per hour of operating, because the networks aren't there.
The banks do that with checks, too.
Well, you have a parallel to your view of banks with all kinds of documents. So what we need is we need a protocol that has concurrency. We need the ability to send files in a way that allows them to go faster, in maybe 10, 100 times faster, because I looked at all that and I went, well, you know what's going to happen with all of these quantified self-devices? They're all fairly narrowband. They're recording your steps and things. But there are people talking about doing real-time views of your body, you know, actually doing 3D scans. And if you have rich data files, you have megabytes or gigabytes or even terabytes of file on you, and then you're looking for the small changes in those, the delta, you're going to have these files all over the place for people to look at, the cardiologists, you know, and everybody else. And I just cringe at how this is going to happen.
That's going to be managed, yeah. So, Joe, let me bring you in at this point, because this is actually a really interesting segue.
Yep.
You guys are working on a whole Internet of Everything platform right now.
Yep.
But one of the things that Cisco has successfully done in the past, even using one of Alex's pals, Ray Kurzweil, was a victim of this, or a tester of this. It was a live holographic transmission across the world from America to Japan, right?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, I was doing some work with Ray at Microsoft, and he was telling us about it looked so real that people were trying to get autographs from the hologram.
So, you know, what sort of bandwidth would it take to project a holographic image across the world using sort of telepresence?
Well, I think Alex is going to be more of the expert on the engineering side of that from MIT.
But a lot, right?
I could certainly say he's absolutely right in his articulation, his wondering of, you know, where is all this bandwidth going to come from? But more importantly, where is all the processing going to come from? So what Cisco is doing is we're looking at the emergence of a brand new architecture. We're calling it fog computing. This is the idea that, because of what Alex is talking about, are we going to be able to send all of this data from where these devices are? And today, you know, Internet of Things talks about 10 to 15 billion devices and objects in the world today. We see that growing to somewhere around 50 billion or so by 2020, and you think about all the data coming out of these smart devices with intelligence. So fog computing is saying, hey, we better plan for compute, for storage, for data, for applications and analytics at the edge of the network, closer to the device, closer to the user. So this idea of fog is an architecture that sits between these devices and the cloud as we understand it today.
Alex, what about if we turn each of these devices into nodes in a mesh network?
Well, sure. If you want to just share files with people locally, that's fine. Mesh networks can, if you want to have end-to-end communication worldwide that's comparable to the phone system, think of the phone system. Brett, you travel more than anyone that I know. But I can reach you in Australia, I can reach you in Abu Dhabi, I can reach you by just dialing the same number.
Yeah.
That's because you have a static phone number. In contrast, when you're trying to do a lot of internet things, especially on mobile devices, you are given a dynamic IP address. Normally, 99% of the time, the word dynamic is good. In this case, it's bad because it means that the phone company can loan you the number and then snatch it back because people are stuck using Internet Protocol version 4. It's a 32-bit address, so there's only 4.3 billion addresses. And if our colleague is correct that there'll be 50 billion connected devices, well, not everybody can have their own static number that you can keep the end-to-end architecture together. And a mesh network doesn't stop that. You have to actually move to a protocol like IPv6 and implement that change architecture-wide. And the cloud doesn't solve that problem either. The cloud is allows for economies of scale, and it's particularly wonderful for entrepreneurs who have seen their cost of doing high-tech startups plunge because of the wonderful work done by companies like Cisco. But I just think that this whole quantified self thing is going to work best when we can have big data and share these databases. So for instance, right, for medical data, there are 36 databases that the U.S. government keeps track of health-related information on, and half of those have your name, and they know who you are, and the other half, they're stripped of your identifying data, and they just keep the aggregate numbers. But if we can actually know if you eat this food and this food in combination with this medicine, and this is your life expectancy, yeah, but you eat that food and you avoid this and this, your life expectancy is 20 years more, that's worth quite a lot. Michael Milken said something extremely provocative.
So Alex, I just want to jump in there because we are going to have to go to a quick break. But let's continue this after the break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We'll be right back after this short break.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back from the break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. We are live from New York today. You're listening out on the AM band 1160 WVNJ. Hello to you guys out there. And then Voice America, 72 countries now we have Voice America, 250,000 listeners. That's fantastic. So thanks, guys. I know some of you are regular listeners, and some of you also will attend Finovate either in Europe or Spring out on the West Coast this year. If you're listening to Breaking Banks, we just have done a new media partnership with the team at Finovate. And if you use the discount code BREAKINGBANKS20, you get a 20% discount at Finovate. So showing some love out to you guys. Thanks for that. Okay, before the break, we were talking about the Internet of Things. And Joe, Cisco, you guys started out talking about Internet of Things, but now you call it the Internet of Everything. Why do you call it the Internet of Everything?
That's right. Well, while the Internet of Things talks about basic connectivity, often point-to-point or single-purpose, the Internet of Everything is about the network connection of people, processes, data, and things. And from an IOE, Internet of Everything, standpoint, we think about smart and connected cities, smart and connected buildings, smart and connected transportation, connected health, and so on. We think of value in terms of connections. In fact, I was remembering in talking to you yesterday, Brett, I had worked a little bit for Bob Metcalf when he was the editor-in-chief.
Yeah. The founder of Gilda's Law.
Right? Bob Metcalf, co-inventor of Ethernet. And I remember I had a chance.
Metcalf's Law, rather.
Metcalf's Law, exactly.
What am I saying? Gilda's Law. Metcalf's Law.
Well, I thought there was another law I didn't know about, which is very possible.
Metcalf, which is every node that connects to the network.
That's right. The value of the network, he used to say, is the square of the number of users on the network. So I got to meet Bob for an hour while I was writing these articles once, and he would talk about this Metcalf's Law, and it started to really make sense later in my career. I wasn't too sure about it, but now we can all feel the experience of that. So the old analogy that Bob would talk about is fax machines way back when. So Brett, if I had a fax machine and Brett, you had a fax machine, there was a lot of value between that two-node usage scenario.
What's a fax machine?
I don't know. I'm going to have to ask my father, I think. I've heard of these things. But then let's say Alex was interested. He might not be interested if he didn't have any business interests or community interests. But let's say he's interested and we bring 8 more people on. Suddenly, we went from 2 possible connections to 100 possible connections. So we could begin to see the value of this example here as we move into the era of Internet of Everything. When you take the user definition in Metcalf's Law and you start to think about smart objects and devices, right, in place of the word user, you start to think what becomes possible across all these different industries and scenarios from person to person, from machine to person, from machine to machine for smart connections. We begin to see exponential growth in value. In fact, I can point folks to a study that Cisco did. I believe it was towards the end of 2013, that talked about $19 trillion in value at stake being created over the next decade by this Internet of Everything phenomenon.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a huge opportunity. There was some great work done in researching the effect the Internet had on employment. Did it kill jobs or did it create jobs? And for every job that the Internet killed, it created 2.3 new jobs, right? Where does that research come from, Alex?
There's not just one source of it, but the idea of churn is quite popular because we want people not to fear the future. So yeah. I would imagine that that you would be well served in your book Augmented to have a section about the value of churn. So for instance, if these people all leave banks because of what's happening with banks, where will they go instead? And actually, they'll go on to a bigger and better place because it's not that much fun being a teller.
True, true. So that's a good segue, Alex. So in terms of Internet of Everything, Joe, what are you guys doing in respect to the fintech world enabling, what sort of everything devices are being connected on the fintech and banking side?
Well, it comes back down to that very basic value prop about connections and the value there in Metcalf's Law. In financial services, it's about the smart and connected financial consumer or client. A lot of the things that you're doing yourself at Movin, Brett, and that you're writing your books about, it's about the smart and connected financial advisor. It's about the smart and connected bank as a holistic service where we call application-centric infrastructure, which is another architecture that we believe is going to be needed in the banks, is going to be required to serve up these high-value capabilities and experiences, especially in the mobile world. We're seeing the need, again, for the architectural shift to fog computing. But in all of this, at the end of the day, it's about connections and bringing banking clients closer to the bank across multiple different channels, especially digital mobile channels.
Sure. At this point, what I might like to do, guys, is invite a couple more guests onto the show. We have also joining us, I actually don't know where they physically are today, but we have joining us from the team at Luxoft and Radius, which was their In the Things business they acquired, Anders and Michael. Anders and Michael, welcome to Breaking Banks. That's Anders Brown and Michael Menkovic.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm actually out here in Seattle.
Seattle, where
are you? I'm on Hawaii right now.
Oh, you're in Hawaii?
Yeah.
It's a bit warmer than New York, I bet. Very nice. Well, thanks for joining us on your family vacation. Now, Michael, you guys acquired Radius specifically to sort of build this competency in terms of the Internet of Things. And you know, you're a services business servicing a lot of fintech and based companies. So what was it about Radius and the Internet of Things that was important for you guys at Luxoft?
As Luxoft is not a household name like Cisco yet, I'll give you just a quick background information about the company. So we are a global software house established in the year 2000. Currently, we employ more than 9,000 engineers worldwide. The company is headquartered in Zug, Switzerland, and listed at New York Stock Exchange. And we focus on a number of verticals: financial services, aviation and travel, energy and utilities, oil and gas, automotive, telecommunications, and digital media. And our customers, the customer portfolio includes big multinationals such as Boeing, IBM, HP, Broadcom, Dell, Fiverr, as well as smaller ISVs. And for all of them, we build systems and applications of various scope and scale and support them throughout the entire life cycle. And Luxoft is in no way new to the Internet of Things. MTM applications have been on our radar for quite some time. Our R&D arm called Luxoft Lab started experimenting with wireless sensor networks and smart dust, early predecessors of the IoT back in 2003. And one of our spin-offs called Meshnetics was one of the pioneers of the Zigbee standard. And was eventually acquired by Atmel in 2008. So by 2014, we already had a track record of successful projects for multiple industries: connected car and automotive telematics, demand management for smart grid, smart lighting for home and building automation, distribution management system for utilities, and more. But we realized that the landscape was changing. And historically, traditional MCM applications have predominantly built siloed, vertical-oriented, self-contained, and based on proprietary protocols. On the contrary, the brave new world of IoT, as predicted by most of the experts, should be based on open standards and APIs, which unify and reusable components and platforms at all layers of the application stack. So we realized it was a good time for us to start building a company-wide horizontal Internet of Things practice that would accumulate all relevant technical expertise and would span across multiple vertical practices. So the main question was whether we would grow it organically or acquire an external entity to serve the kind of nucleus for a new center of expertise. So we leaned towards the M&A scenario as we felt that the company needs some fresh blood, and this is how Luxoft met with Radius.
Okay, so Anders, in terms of Radius, I found it was interesting. We've been talking about all these big numbers. You guys are saying that by 2020, that the size of the Internet of Things from a marketplace perspective is going to be $7 trillion, and we could have more than 200 billion connected devices in the next decade. That's a lot bigger estimates than we've heard earlier in the show.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's plenty of people out there that are predicting what that number is going to be. I think there's a couple things we can agree on. First, it'll be a big number, whether it's $50 billion or $100 billion or $200 billion. I think the important point from our standpoint is that it's way more of devices than people are going to be carrying around in their pocket around mobile phones, as an example. And so I think we're very similar to Cisco's view and what Joe was talking about. When you think about that device count, at least from our perspective, the fascinating piece is how many of those devices either aren't yet in an enterprise environment. So we talk a lot about the health devices, the fitness trackers. As Alex was saying, you see those all over CES. We think those get really interesting, though, when they're placed in the context of an enterprise, let's say. You have devices that haven't been invented yet that are going to cover that device count. So for sure, there's plenty of predictions out there, but I think we're in all agreement that the number is going to be pretty darn big. And I think from the market segment standpoint, that just means opportunity for people up and down that value chain, from services companies like ourselves to hardware and software companies like Cisco, to companies dealing with consumers like the financial services industry. And so I think the real opportunity is to frame out how you think about it and try to pick the piece of that puzzle you're going to go after. But clearly there's a lot of value to be traded.
So Alex, do you see industries getting together and sort of defining some data standards around this? You talked a lot about the health industry. You know, it seems like the fitness industry and the health industry are really where there's explosion of sensors right now. Is there any sort of uniform industry approaches to this that you're seeing?
There are approaches in the book called Innovation Stake by Anish Chopra, who is the first chief technology officer. He says one of the big opportunities of the present moment is for HISPs, health ISPs, because we have HIPAA standards for data encryption and security. I have a dear friend who works at Sony, used to work at Sony. Sony was hacked and her medical records were obtained. Well, Sony has friends in the U.S. government because you can be fined up to $2,500 per record per day that your data has been accessed. And so the actual fine that could be levied against Sony now could bankrupt the company. That means that there's a level of liability attached to medical records that makes them kind of like handling plutonium. They have to be cared for in a special way. So we are going to need a whole new set of standards that have
as opposed to bank records, which get hacked all the time, right?
Well, I mean, there are certain records that if you hack them, you can't prove a certain level of loss or liability for insurance purposes. You said you'd wanted to talk about insurance, so perhaps this is a segue. But we now are doing so much of our work through networks that we really need to have actuarial tables of what the risk of certain kinds of data is, so that people will pay more to protect it and they'll get better security. And we don't have those numbers yet, so it's a kind of an anomaly, and it's not the economist's dream of a fully efficient market with perfectly shared information, because some people know much more about what records can be hacked and sold.
Yeah, and in respect to sort of marrying the data with the devices, This sounds like this is not just an issue of actually connecting a device. We're really sort of having to figure out about what is the transport layer for the data and where does it get stored and who looks after it. Are you guys involved in working on those problems with your clients?
Yeah, I mean, if you frame up the kind of layers, again, I'll go back to what Joe had said. I think we agree that you kind of have this edge of the internet around the application or the sensor, something that is sourcing or sending data. That data has to get to a cloud infrastructure someplace. Sometimes it's part of a enterprise company that's running their own, like an insurance company, let's say, that maybe has their own cloud, or maybe it's a third party. And then you have some layer of data or analytics, which is really really where the value will be created. And if you look at some of the work that we've done, we've been very active in a really fascinating trend around big data in agriculture. And if you look at that industry, and I'd say that we see this similar framework in many industries, you have an industry that really inherently is not technology driven. It's been dominated through productivity by improvements in hardware, better, faster tractors, better, faster planters, better, faster harvesters, but really kind of mechanical hardware innovation on one side. And then on the other
side, productivity around the
inputs, the seed. So companies like Monsanto have done incredible things there to just make a farmer's efficiency great.
Don't get Alex started on Monsanto, whatever you do.
Data and how they're going to interact is where the future is. Okay. So, yeah, figuring out how to grab that data and get some value out of it is for sure a spot that we spend a lot of time on.
Great. Well, I just want to go to a quick break, guys. Alex?
I have exactly one compliment about Monsanto, and I'll blow it all right now, which is they were brilliant to buy the Climate Corporation for $1 billion and have the leading leading source of all of that climate data to have better ability to predict food.
Fair enough. Well, that was positive. Let's not dive into that. So listen, we got to go to a quick break, guys. What I want to do after the break is come back and let's talk about how the Internet of Things is going to change the world of banking and insurance after the break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We'll be right back in a few moments.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. And before the break, we were talking Internet of Things. Quick shout out to some of our listeners out there. Hello to David Breer. I guess, David, I think you're in London. So it's in the early evening there. And Andy, I don't know if Andy McLean, who I mentioned before, was tweeting from Bali. It must be like 4 or 5 in the morning there. So, Andy, thanks for that. A few others, you know who you are. Thanks for listening and tweeting out. If you want to join the Twitter conversation online, use the hashtag BreakingBanks. Okay, so let me throw this one at you first, Anders. Okay, I'm really interested in this intersection between sensors and the ability that drives advice, because the financial service advice and risk. The financial service industry is hung up on this fact that you need a person to give good advice, and you need a human interaction to mitigate risk because you collect identity documents and things like this. But when we start looking at things like self-driving cars and insuring a self-driving car, or health insurance and life insurance, and connecting these sensors, my belief is this is going to really dramatically change the way we measure risk and the way we look at customers and the way we provide advice and measure risk for them. Is that your experience with where you're seeing fintech go?
Yeah, I mean, for me, a lot of these sensors comes down to the idea of providing context. And so right now, if you look at, traditional financial services industry, you have a person has context, they have some properties about them, and really that context, who I am, what I'm doing, is kind of different than my financial profile, from my financial context. And I think to the extent that those things can get merged, without a human intervention in there, you can end up with some interesting scenarios. And some of those scenarios are enabled because some of the incredible things going on the data side around things like machine learning and predictive analysis. And so I don't know if we would predict that for sure. There's not absolutely a place for people in the financial services industry, or any industry for that matter, that are kind of in between, in creating that context, I guess by hand or by paper. But for sure we can say the more that these ecosystems of data can get together and they can get merged and you can get value from those, that'll create value and efficiency. And to Alex's point, you'll start to lose some people on some end and they'll go do higher value things in that industry. So I think we share that viewpoint for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe Joe, let me ask you this. We had this question tweeted in. In the next 5 years, in terms of the Internet of Everything and the impact on financial services, where do you think the impact will be in the next 5 years? Is it products? Is it services? Is it engagement?
I think it's all of the above, and I would start by saying, read some of the books that Brett has put out and the others on this call. Banks are starting to really study this up. We're starting to see innovation centers pop up in Silicon Valley by banks, a bank showing up at the Finovate conferences. So they're really starting to get the need to really invest in this digital age of Internet of Everything. We're already seeing things. Some research came out in the last couple of weeks about assets under management of robo-advisors
yep.
being something along the lines of $14 billion. And if you talk to seasoned bankers about that, they say, that's kind of an interesting thing, but money managers are really having something like $5 trillion assets under management. But they are paying attention because if you look at that hockey stick growth curve, these things are creating a solution for gaps in the marketplace. So, so banks are seeing this. And we here, in my group, Business Transformation Group at Cisco, are seeing that there could be two effects to this, let's say, in an advisor-client scenario in wealth management, for example. And it's either going to kick up a lot more activity between the client, having all of this intelligence on the device, all of these data feeds coming in from the public, asking more questions, more inquiries about asset allocations and, basic financial planning. So we think that's one scenario. Another one is it creates distance.
Yeah.
And then questions the very value prop. So the result, and it's beginning to happen right now, is that the bar is going up in a bank for financial advice because the costs are coming down at the lower end of the market. You've got wealth transfer happening. You've got the emerging affluent coming up. And the fear is if you don't capture the emerging affluent who have this digital expectation, you might lose that transition in the market.
Here's an interesting one. I'm not sure who wants to answer this, whether it's Anders or Michael or Alex. I'm sure Alex will have an answer. But one of the interesting things here is if you think about the sort of data we're capturing regarding our health, it impacts medical, it impacts the fitness industry, and it definitely impacts the insurance industry. So are those classifications of industries or sectors, maybe is it that we're going to see some new industry definitions come out, the new sectors, you know, these combined sectors defined by data relationships and, you know, the Internet of Things. Who wants to tackle that?
Well, I'll start off with a big picture, which is that the medical industry in the United States is approximately $3 trillion. The fitness industry is $56 billion. So we're talking about a flea on the tail of the dog in terms of the fitness industry. And the fitness industry exists to sell two things: memberships to people who won't go to the gym and personal training tickets for people who do. And I'm not so sure that these people are trained to look at that data because it is more medical data. But what I think it will do, and I'll just say this so I give my colleagues more time to address it, is that the overwhelming change will be that people will wake up and smell the digital coffee and they'll take responsibility for their own health. Because there are certain simple basic things that you can do which radically alter the trajectory of your life and wellness and income. And one of those is to run or get your heart rate up for 30 minutes a day. That's almost as good as an hour. And the second one is to get your heart rate for men above 75% of maximum heart rate for 45 minutes. And that creates new brain cells. And new brain cells, to me, are the most valuable thing on earth after antimatter. Antimatter costs $20 million a gram. New brain cells in your own brain is the next most valuable thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is obviously a key problem. If you watch YouTube or Fox News, we obviously need more brain cells in the world. But anyway.
Yeah, but you know, on that point as well, we're starting to see these use cases come up where doctors are taking video appointments of patients that live in different states across the United States. In banking, Boston Consulting did some research on the wealth business for 2014, and they found up to a 60% gap between wealth clients, right, existing paying wealth clients, and banks who provided video access to the financial advisor the way Amazon does with their Mayday facility. So we think, you know, to add to that question that came in before, we think there's an immediate opportunity to increase client satisfaction, maybe to increase assets under management and net new assets by doing some of these simple things with off-the-shelf technology that's provided today.
Anders, do you think this is going to spurn new industries and new specializations?
Yeah, I think your question is a great one, because if you look at it, you know, you have a bunch of fitness stuff happening, like Alex mentioned, and that has some light data, but it's really, I go into my workout facility and I do some stuff, but I don't have really any context there. I don't have any, you know, thing that can be passed now to the other industry, the insurance industry, which right now has very coarse grain information, you know, age, are you a smoker, are you married?
Right.
Oh, and so both of those industries have been basically separate. So what's happening, because folks like Joe and Cisco are helping it along and we're trying to stitch together the solutions for companies, is I can now, you know, take some sensors, take some wearables, take some low-cost communications and try to connect those things. And I think it's that connection that's going to provide enormous value and, frankly, lots of energy in lots of segments. And I know that we've seen something where we read our first article where a large Fortune 1000 company deploys a Fitbit or deploys a fitness band to their health or to their employee base, because the insurance companies say, hey, I'll give you some value for that. You know, if we can figure out this data thing and figure out the privacy thing, you know, we can make something of it. And so those are some kind of leading indicators we're looking for. But for sure, these industries will have lots of ways to kind of play from their current incumbent position into new markets that maybe they didn't think were part of their market before, but now it is because of the new technologies and the new IoT platforms that are out there.
Can I throw one tiny bit of data cold water on the quantified self and corporations idea?
Yep.
Corporations like to show competence, and they don't continue with programs that make them look like failures. And nothing has failed on a wide scale that has been unreported, quite like corporate fitness programs. So over the past 5 years, corporations have spent $6 billion. And do you know what the average weight lost in a corporate weight loss program has been? 1 pound per person per year for the most successful third. So I'm not so sure they're going to want to go and do these quantified self programs unless they actually have at least one example of a corporation that has a big success, because I don't think it shows competence.
I don't know why. For some reason, that reminds me of the fact that we failed with cross-sell and upsell after 10 years of investment. We didn't change the cross-sell-upsell ratio in financial services at all. But here's the other interesting sort of lead-in here, guys. And again, Anders and Alex, I know you guys are both going to have an opinion on this. But all of this data that's being collected, would you guys agree that banks would, in their current form, would really struggle to use that data?
Let's ask Anders to go first. If Anders would like to go first, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. One is, I think, based on our experience, as well as, you know, Michael, I'm sure, would weigh in just from a Luxoft perspective globally, I think banks and the banking industry will just have an infrastructure challenge to even, you know, think about how to capture this data. So there's definitely some technical work there. But I think more importantly, the challenge is going to be what do you do with it? It's kind of like Alex's comment on you got to find a leading indicator that there's value there. So I think, like a lot of industries, you're going to have to find those folks in these companies that say, actually, I do have a vision against maybe the backdrop of ideas that have been, you know, put on the shelf in the past. But somebody's got to think about it and kind of lean in and come up with a solution. So in the short term, I think for sure there's challenges. Longer term, perhaps they can crack that nut.
I think there's hope. This is Joe again, and a compelling event coming up around risk data aggregation. This BCBS 239 thing seems to have some legs. At least people are paying attention. There was a self-assessment done in the industry by the GSIB, Global Systemically Important Banks, which came back and showed that there was material noncompliance in data architecture and capabilities across 5 of the 18 principal areas. There's a deadline in January of 2016. So I think that we're going to see a lot of what needs to be done to break down data silos and re-architecture and prepare for the Internet of Everything come from regulatory funding, you know, to be compliant.
Well, guys, it's been a fantastic show. We need to wrap up. We're in our last minute on the show. Just a quick shout out to Dave Birch. He said, don't listen to the madmen. Stop the madness. The Internet of Things is a Chernobyl, people. A Chernobyl. So there might be some truth to that. There's obviously needs some structure put in place. But Dave Birch, our friend from UK, sorry, pal, it's inevitable. So you've been listening to Breaking Banks. Thanks to Michael from Luxoft. Thanks to Anders from Luxoft Radius. Alex Lightman, thanks again for joining us from wonderful Santa Monica. And Joe Pagano here in the office for Cisco and the Internet of Everything. Thanks, gents, for joining Breaking Banks today.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
All right, we'll be back next week, guys. We're going to be talking about some startups and following up on Cyboss and the InterTribe startup competition, and a bit of a roundup on some of the hot startups to watch for fintech in 2015. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. Check out our host page, our webpage, breakingbanks.com. We'll see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.